at the man's sudden shock, Moloch said, "Not military weapons. The kind that are used in big construction jobs, like reversing the course of the Lena River." "Whatever do you need them for?" Moloch was enjoying Lermontov's obvious surprise and worry. "You know that the American altered the course of an asteroid, a big chunk of rock and metal?" "Yes. It will move into an orbit around the Earth, won't it?" "If we leave it alone, it will." The KGB man's face seemed to pull itself into a wrinkled frown of curiosity and fear. "I plan to send a special team of cosmonauts to that asteroid and use the hydrogen bombs to alter its course still further, so that it will plunge into the Earth. By all the saints, we will drop it into the American Midwest somewhere. We can't guide it too precisely, of course, but imagine the impact of a few million tons of rock on one of those Midwestern American states, such as Kansas or Missouri." Lermontov seemed to be having trouble catching his breath. "It would be like 100 hydrogen bombs hitting them all at once. Like the hand of God smiting them." "A disaster? A calamity," Moloch agreed. "Of course, there would be no radiation, no fallout. The calamity would not harm any other nation. But why?" Reaching across his desk to stub out his cigarette, Moloch said, "What better way to convince the world that Dan Randolph and all his capitalist ilk should be rounded up and hanged? He will get blamed for the disaster, of course. It will be the final nail in his coffin." Chapter 33. Nobo had thought it would be difficult to arrange an unscheduled flight to Nueva Venezuela on such short notice, especially when his call to Dan resulted in the phone computer telling him that Mr. Randolph was asleep and not to be disturbed except for an emergency. Sitting in an office at the launch complex, with Lucita perched on a plastic chair watching him, Nobo debated waking Dan. The room was a Spartan, utilitarian office, shared by temporary workers, little more than a desk, a computer terminal, and a hook on the back of the door to hang a coat. It was frigidly air-conditioned. Americans were not satisfied with air-conditioning until it made one's sinuses ache, Nobuhiko thought. Lucita seemed chilled. She sat with her arms wrapped around herself, even though she had changed into a pair of jeans and a sensible, comfortable, long-sleeved blouse at Nobo's suggestion. Skirts and dresses that looked fine on Earth were out of place aboard a space station, especially in the zero-gravity areas, he had reminded her. On an impulse, he put through a call to Zach Freiberg at the Astro offices in Caracas. The scientist listened to Nobo's worries about Dan, then agreed to arrange for a shuttle to take him and Lucita to the space station. "Give me a half hour to talk to the chief of operations out there," Freiberg said. "I found that once you convince him to go to the expense of flying a shuttle up to the station, he fills it up with all the people who've been pestering him for the past week for an extra flight." So it was arranged. From the office window, Lucita watched as two van loads of technicians rode out to one of the three double-decker aerospace planes parked in a silent waiting row across the field. Like inquisitive ants, they crawled around the huge craft and then climbed up a ladder and disappeared inside it. She turned to check the digits of the clock on the bare metal desk and saw that Nobo was watching her, his face a blank mask of oriental patience. Slowly, the ground crew fueled the massive lifter aircraft and its piggyback orbiter. After nearly 2 hours had passed, a flight crew of 3 men and 4 women drove out to the ship and entered it. The minutes flicked by slowly. At last, Lucita heard, even at this distance and through the triple-paned windows, the thundering whine of the lifter's powerful jet engines. The double-decked craft trundled slowly from its parking place across the field to the loading ramp near the office building, with the orbiter perched atop it. 48 people, including Lucita and Nobo, walked through the boarding tunnel and took seats inside the orbiter. It was an old ship, no longer used for the commercial flights that brought tourists to Nueva Venezuela, or even for the regularly scheduled cargo runs from the space factory. It was kept for emergencies, like this one. "I never realized that Dan had so many Japanese working for his company," Lucita said as they took their seats. "Space construction is one of the most popular career choices in Japan," Nobo replied. "There are many Japanese working in all the space facilities." The interior of the shuttle was much like the interior of a well-worn airliner, except that there were no windows. Once, when this craft had been used to ferry tourists to Nueva Venezuela, there had been television screens set into the backs of the seats. so that the passengers could see views of the Earth and the station, or pre-recorded safety or entertainment tapes. Now the seat backs were blank. Employees had seen the views before. They needed no entertainment, and they were required to know the safety regulations before making their first flight into space. The flight was uneventful, and the zero-gravity portion of it was so brief that Lucida did not have the time to worry about being sick. She rather enjoyed the feeling of weightlessness. It was like floating, or better yet, like the unearthly feeling she had gotten the first time she had smoked a whole marijuana cigarette all by herself, in the darkness of the cellar under her convent school dormitory. There were no stewards or stewardesses to help her once the orbiter had docked at the space station's zero-gravity hub. The other passengers, Astro employees or technicians of one kind or another, were expected to make their own way through the dock area and down the connecting tubes to the station's living and working areas. Lucida, whose only previous experience in orbit had been aboard Cosmograd, allowed Novo to take her hand and lead her gently to the tube hatch. At first, it was like floating through a smooth, metal-walled tunnel. It was brightly lit, and there were plenty of other men and women both ahead of them and behind. Lucida was glad she had changed into the slacks and blouse. Before long, Novo guided her hands to the rungs of the ladder built into the tube's wall, and within moments she was descending step by step, with Novo just below her and another Japanese, a stranger, a few rungs above. They reached the bottom of the tube at last, and Novo held open the heavy metal hatch there. Lucida stepped through and into a beautifully furnished lounge area, richly carpeted, its curving walls decorated in warm reds and oranges and ochres. A single long window showed a slice of the gleaming blue and white earth, so beautiful that most of the other visitors were drawn to the window, clustering there as if to a religious shrine. But Novo was frowning, Lucida saw. "Why are we being detained here in the reception lounge?" he wondered aloud. "These are all Astro employees, not tourists." The far door to the lounge opened, and a short, thick-set man in a tan military uniform entered the lounge. He had a glistening leather holster strapped to his hip. Two grim-faced soldiers stood behind him carrying machine pistols. "Ladies and gentlemen," said the officer in heavily accented English, "this facility is now under the control of the Soviet Union's Space Forces. All regular activities have been suspended pending the arrest and transportation of certain criminals whom we believe to be aboard this station. You will remain here until further notice. Stay calm and follow all orders given by Soviet authorities. Those who do not follow orders are subject to arrest. My troops have orders to shoot anyone who offers active resistance." As he repeated the words, in even worse Spanish, Lucida turned, white-faced with fear, to Nobuhiko. "Too late," she whispered. "We are too late." Major Igor Konstantinovich Ostrovsky always became ill in zero gravity. For the entire duration of the 40-minute flight from Cosmograd to Nueva Venezuela, he was sick as the proverbial dog. He sat in the frontmost seat in the passenger module of the spacecraft, his back to the 30 other Soviet soldiers of his command, so they could not see his ashen, agonized face or his knobby hands gripping the armrests so tightly that all the blood seemed squeezed out of them. In front of Major Ostrovsky was the blank bulkhead that separated the flight compartment from the passenger module. Ostrovsky stared at it, studying every scuff mark and scrape on the bare, worn metal. He held himself rigidly motionless. He felt as if he were falling, dropping endlessly into a long, dark pit. His stomach was trying to crawl up his throat. If he turned his head even the slightest fraction of a millimeter, the whole world seemed to swim giddily and the nausea threatened to overwhelm him. So he sat as motionless as a dead and fossilized creature, trying to will himself into stony insensitivity. Behind him, over the whir of the air circulation fans and the incessant hum of electrical equipment, he could hear an occasional groan from his troops. They were all trained men, volunteers from the Strategic Rocket Corps' own special soldiery, but still the queasiness of zero gravity got to some of them. They did not have the Major's iron self-discipline, however. Several of them used the wretch bags that were part of their standard equipment. Each time one of them vomited, the noise made Ostrovsky's guts churn. He tasted acrid bile in his throat, but he fought it down in silent, grim determination. Two Soviet spacecraft were approaching Nueva Venezuela, both under Ostrovsky's command. each carried 30 arms.